Chapter 11. The three reacted as one. Cabrillo tossed Soleil's bag to Smith, since he was as close to the rightful owner as he could get, and together they raced for the stairwell up and out of the temple complex. His supposition that Soleil and what's-his-name had been attacked by rebels or drug smugglers was obviously false. The chopper had to belong to the military, which meant these were reinforcements for a patrol that had to be someplace close by. Soleil must have either stumbled onto it or run into a group that had betrayed them to the military. Either way, it was rotten luck for the two hikers, and was now just as bad for Cabrillo and his team. They raced through the main temple, flew past the dorm level, and ran up to the ground-level entrance.
"We've got company," McDee said unnecessarily.
The helicopter came in low enough for Cabrillo to recognize it through the canopy as an old Russian mill Mi-8. They could pack more than 24 combat soldiers in one.
"Okay, we've got one shot at this," he said. "We've got to get across the river and into the forest before the pilot can find a place to set down."
"Why not try to hide on this side and cross later?" Smith asked.
Cabrillo didn't waste the breath explaining that guards would doubtlessly be posted on the rope bridge, and he didn't fancy hiking days or even weeks to find another way across.
"Linda, you go first, then Smith, McDee, and me. Got it?"
With the helicopter drumming the air, the four of them sprinted from the temple entrance, keeping as much cover as possible between them and the aircraft overhead. Given how dense the jungle was, it wasn't too difficult. They only had 100 yards to cover, but the problem would be once they reached the bridge. It was totally exposed. The beat of the rotors changed as the pilot transited into a hover. Juan knew that meant the men were coming down fast ropes and would be on the ground in seconds. This was going to be close. Linda reached the bridge and kept on going, not breaking stride. Her feet danced along the main cable, one hand bracing along the guideline, the other clutching her Rec-7. Smith let her get a few paces out before he committed himself to the rickety structure. His added weight gave the bridge a burgeoning sway. It creaked ominously, and several of the support ropes snapped free. Cabrillo and McDee ran side by side, knowing that less than 100 yards back, the Mi-8 had disgorged its passengers and begun lifting clear, its huge rotor beating at the hot, fetid air. A stream of tracer rounds ripped across their path, forcing both men to dive flat. Juan flipped around and opened fire, laying down a suppressive wall of lead to allow McDee to start across the bridge. Cabrillo wriggled behind a rock, and whenever he saw movement in the jungle behind them, he triggered off a 3-round burst. A grenade came lobbing out of the bush. Juan made himself as small as possible behind his rock as the poorly thrown explosive went off with a concussive whoosh. Shrapnel chewed the dirt around him, but nothing struck home. Lawless was halfway across. On the far side, Linda made it to solid ground and immediately twisted around one of the support pylons and added her own cover fire. From Cabrillo's position, the muzzle flash looked like twinkling stars. He changed out his half-depleted magazine for a fresh one, loosed a long burst of autofire, and exploded from his hidden position. He felt like he had a giant target pinned to his back, and that his legs were encased in lead. It seemed harder to run than when they'd hit that ooze just off the boat. Cabrillo slung his rifle across his back when his boot hit the bridge. It jolted and jumped like it was carrying a live electrical current. Ahead of him, McDee was moving as fast as he could, while Smith made it to the other side. Like Linda, he found cover behind the support pillar and opened fire. Bullets cut the air all around Juan as he tried to both keep his balance and run. He didn't recall the thick braided rope being so narrow. 100 feet below him, the water was a white, frothing nightmare. Expecting a bullet in his back at any second, he kept running, the cable swaying all the while like an old hammock. With his eyes on his feet, it was a miracle he looked up at the instant he did. A little ways ahead of McDee, bullets slammed into the cable, fired no doubt by the Burmese soldiers. It disintegrated in a fur ball of hemp fibers, and, as soon as the two ends parted, the guide ropes took the added strain. "Down!" Cabrillo shouted over the din of battle, and threw himself onto the quivering main cable. McDee dropped flat, clutching at the foot-thick rope with his arms and leg. Even when the structure was first built, the guidelines were never designed to carry the load of the main cable. They lasted the seconds it took Cabrillo to spin himself around so he was facing the temple. He had one instant to see that a pair of soldiers in jungle fatigues had also started across the bridge, their AKs slung low across their bellies. First, one guideline split apart, rotating the entire bridge in a gut-wrenching jolt. The second let go an instant later, and Cabrillo was suddenly in free fall, clinging to the rope as it arced back toward the Buddhist sanctuary, accelerating with every second. Wind whistled past his ears while the world tilted and spun. The two Burmese soldiers hadn't seen what was coming. Screaming, one hurtled off the span, his arms and legs pinwheeling until he smashed into the rocks below. The river washed away the crimson smear he'd left on the stone and carried the body away. The second soldier managed to grab at the guidelines as they sagged like deflated balloons. Juan redoubled his grip and braced for impact, knowing that if he lost his tenuous hold, he also lost his life. He hit unyielding stone like he'd been struck by a bus. He felt his collarbone snap like a green twig, and his entire left side go numb for an instant. And then his brain rebooted, and the agony struck his nervous system from his ankle to his head. Blood dripped from a gash on his temple, and it took everything he had not to just let go and be done with it all. The soldier who'd clutched at the rope at the last second gave a warning shriek as he lost his hold and came tumbling down the cliff face. There was nothing Juan could do. The guy struck him a glancing blow that caused him to slip a little farther down the cable, and then he was gone. Cabrillo looked down to see him sail past McDee, who had somehow stayed on, even though he'd fallen farther and hit even harder. The soldier plummeted into the water head first and vanished. Juan never did see him surface. He was stuck. With his broken collarbone, there was no way he could climb up the cable, and he knew there was no way he'd survive a plunge into the river. He thought that maybe he and McDee could swing the rope across the cliff and somehow land on the water wheel platform, but that wouldn't work either. It was just too far away. Cabrillo looked up, expecting to see the triumphant faces of soldiers aiming down at him. He could no longer hear any firing from Linda's side of the chasm, and assumed that when the rope parted, she and Smith had beaten a fast retreat. The soldiers could be choppered over in just a few minutes, so it made no sense for them to linger over a situation over which they had no control. The cable began to shake with a slow rhythm, and it took him just a moment to realize that the Burmese soldiers, rather than shooting the two of them off the rope like flies, were hauling him and McDee up the canyon rim to a fate that would probably make dropping into the river seem like the lesser of two evils. But as long as he was alive and had Max Hanley and the rest of the corporation as backup, Juan Cabrillo would never give up. 24 hours later, he wished he had. It took the soldiers nearly 10 minutes to haul first Cabrillo and then McDee out of the gorge. By then, Juan's shoulder felt like it had been lanced with a hot poker, and his arms and legs burned with an unholy fire from clutching the cable. He was disarmed by a soldier wielding a combat knife, who cut the Rec-7 sling before he had been brought fully to the ground. Another soldier plucked his FN-57 from its holster and yanked a throwing knife from its scabbard, hanging inverted from his harness strap. The same was done to McDee when they brought him up from the depths. He'd been so much farther out on the rope than Cabrillo that, when it collapsed, he had actually been dragged into the river. His pants were wet from the knees down. That little bit of a cushion was what saved him from being crushed against the cliff. They were forced to stay on their knees, with two men covering them and a third removing the rest of their gear. It was during the pat-down that they discovered Cabrillo's broken collarbone, which the soldier made sure to knead with both hands until the bones ground together. The pain was intense, but only when the soldier let go did Juan let out a little whimper. He couldn't help it. They also discovered the artificial leg. The soldier turned to an officer wearing aviator-style sunglasses for instructions. A few words were exchanged, and the soldier pulled Juan's combat leg free of its stump and handed it to his superior. The man looked at it for a moment, gave Juan a rotten-toothed smile, and hurled the limb over the edge. He hadn't known what a small arsenal the leg represented, or how Juan had planned to hijack the chopper using the pistol secreted within it. He just wanted to show Cabrillo that he was totally powerless, and that from this moment on, the army of one of the most ruthless dictatorships in the world controlled his fate. Cabrillo had to fight to keep the disappointment from showing on his face. Instead of giving the bastard the satisfaction of knowing how much this really meant, he shrugged as best he could and just looked around at the scenery as if he didn't have a care in the world. If his mouth hadn't been so dry, he would have tried to whistle. The officer didn't like that his demonstration of power hadn't elicited the proper amount of fear, so he barked an order at one of the soldiers covering them. An instant later, the butt of a Kalashnikov smashed into the back of Juan's head, and his world went black. Cabrillo came to in fits and starts. He remembered the awful racket of a chopper flight and being manhandled a couple of times, but each of these memories felt as if it had happened to someone else, like a scene from a movie he'd watched long ago. He never came close enough to consciousness to feel any pain or have any idea where he was. The first sensation when he finally returned from the abyss was an intense ache at the back of his head. More than anything, he wanted to explore the area with his hand and make sure his skull hadn't been crushed in like he was sure it had been. But he resisted the urge. An instructor at Camp Peary, the CIA training facility known as the Farm, had once told him that if he were ever captured and was uncertain of his surroundings, he should lie as quietly as possible for as long as possible. This allowed him to rest, but more important, he could gather intelligence on where he had been taken. So, with the back of his head screaming for attention and other parts of his body sore, he lay dormant, straining to glean anything from his surroundings. He could tell he was still clothed, and knew by the ease with which he could breathe that his head wasn't in a bag. As best he could tell, he was lying on a table. He strained his ears, but could hear nothing. It was difficult to concentrate. His head pounded in time with his beating heart. 10 minutes grew into 15. He was pretty sure he was alone, so he risked opening an eye a fraction of a millimeter. He could make out no shapes, but he saw light, not the brightness of a noonday sun, but the murky glow of an incandescent bulb. He opened his eye a bit more. He could see a bare cement block wall where it joined a concrete ceiling. Both were stained with Jackson Pollock-esque swirls and splashes of a rusty red substance Cabrillo knew to be blood. He remembered that McDee Lawless had also been taken prisoner, so he could only pray that Linda and Smith had gotten out. If they escaped the ambush, he was confident that they would rendezvous with the Oregon. Once they were far enough downriver in the RHIB, Gomez Adams could extract them with the helicopter. The steady beat of pain lancing through his head continued unabated. It was making him a little nauseated, which meant he probably had a concussion. Though he was almost positive he was alone in a cell of some kind, he dared not move his head. There could be hidden cameras or a two-way observation mirror behind him. He did shift a little, like an unconscious person thrashing out. His feet and wrists were bound to the table with steel cuffs. He lay still once again. He was in no shape to stand up to an interrogation, and if they'd brought him to the capital, Yangon, he was most likely in insane prison. Pronounced insane, it was perhaps the most brutal penitentiary on the planet, the deepest of black holes, where escape was impossible, and survival had even longer odds. It housed around 10,000 prisoners, though its capacity was less than half that. Many were political activists and monks who'd spoken out against the regime. The rest were criminals of every kind. Diseases like malaria and dysentery were endemic. Rats outnumbered both the prisoners and the guards. And the tales of torture were the stuff of nightmares. Cabrillo knew they loved to employ rubber hoses filled with sand to beat people, and used attack dogs to force prisoners to race each other across a gravel path on their elbows and knees. His only hope lay in the fact that there was an electronic tracking chip embedded in his thigh, and at this very moment, Max and the rest of the crew were working on getting them out. Out of nowhere, a fist slammed into his jaw, nearly dislocating it. He could have sworn there was nobody else in the room with him. The guy had the patience of a cat. There was no use pretending any longer. He opened his eyes. The man who'd struck him wore a green military uniform. Juan couldn't identify his rank, but managed to take a little satisfaction in the fact that he was massaging his right fist. His head felt like a struck bell. "Name?" the soldier barked. Juan saw two additional guards had come through a metal door. One stayed close to it, while the other took up a position next to a table with a sheet draped over it. He couldn't tell from its outline what lay underneath. When he didn't give his name fast enough, the lead interrogator pulled a length of ordinary garden hose from his belt. By the way it sagged, Juan knew it was a weighted sap. It cracked across his stomach, and no matter how tightly Cabrillo had flexed his abs, the blow felt like it had sunk all the way through to his spine.
"Name?"
"John Smith," Cabrillo said, sucking air through his teeth.
"Who you work for?"
Again, the cudgel whipped across Juan's stomach when he didn't answer instantly.
"Who you work for? CIA? UN?"
"No one. I work for myself."
The hose came down again, this time across Juan's groin. It was too much. He turned his head and retched from the pain. A cultured voice with a tinge of a British accent said,
"I can tell from your accent that you're American."
The unseen speaker was up near the head of the table, where Cabrillo was strapped. Juan heard him light a cigarette, and a moment later, a plume of smoke wafted over his face. The man moved so Cabrillo could see him. He was Burmese, like the others. Juan put his age as in his mid-40s. His face was nut-brown, with lines around the eyes and mouth. He wore a visored cap, but Juan could see his hair was still jet-black. There wasn't anything necessarily malevolent about the officer, but Cabrillo got a cold chill down his spine.
"How is it that you came to be in my country, armed no less? We get so few visitors from the United States that we know exactly how many are within our borders at any given time. You, my friend, should not be here. So tell me, what brings you to Myanmar?"
A line from Casablanca popped into Cabrillo's head.
"My health. I came here for the waters."
The officer chuckled.
"Very good. One of my favorite movies. Claude Rains then says, 'The waters? What waters? We're in the desert.' To which Bogey replies, 'I was misinformed.' Truly a classic."
His voice then cracked. "Mwang!" The hose struck twice in rapid succession, both blows hitting the exact same spot on Juan's broken collarbone. The pain traveled up from his shoulder and slammed into the top of his brain, where it felt like his head would come apart along the cranial sutures.
"Mr. Smith," the lead interrogator went on smoothly, "I mentioned that I believe you are American. I would like to know your feelings on torture. It is a sore subject in your country, I believe. Some feel that even sleep deprivation and exposure to loud music are cruel and inhumane. Where do you stand on this subject?"
"I agree wholeheartedly," Juan said quickly.
"I would imagine a man in your position would," the officer said, a smile plucking at the corners of his mouth. "I wonder if you felt that way yesterday or last week. It doesn't matter. This is your fervent belief now. Of that I am certain."
He did something to a mechanism under the table so that it tipped back slightly, leaving Cabrillo's feet about 12 inches higher than his head. While this was going on, the guard near the table ripped off the sheet to reveal several folded towels and a 1-gallon plastic jug.
"What I really want to know," the officer continued, "is if you believe waterboarding constitutes torture, hmm?"
Juan knew he had a high threshold for pain. He had hoped to hold out for the couple of days he figured it would take Max to bust them out, but he'd never faced the waterboard before and had no idea how he'd react. As a kid, he'd spent countless days swimming off the Southern California coast, and though he'd had water forced up his nose on more than one occasion, he'd never really been as close to drowning as he was about to come. A towel was laid across his face while two powerful hands grabbed his head to keep it from moving. Cabrillo's heart went into overdrive. His hands tensed. He heard water splashing, felt a couple of drops hit his neck, and then he felt moisture on his lips, a dampness at first, but soon his skin was wet. A drop slid down his nose and burned its way into his sinuses. More water was dumped onto the towel, soaking it through. Juan tried to exhale through his nose to stop the water from invading the delicate membranes. It worked for seconds, almost a minute, but his lungs could hold only so much air, and the towel was sodden, a great, clammy weight pressing down on him. At last, there was no more air to fight the inevitable, and water poured into his sinus cavities. Because of the angle of the table, it pooled there and went no farther along his respiratory tract. That was what waterboarding was all about. Make the victim feel he is drowning without actually drowning him. It wasn't a matter of will. Over this, there was no control. When the sinuses fill with water, the brain, having evolved since the first primitive fish walked out of the sea and breathed in its first lungful of air, knew the body was drowning. It was hardwired. Juan could no more control his body's reaction than he could force his liver to produce more bile. His head felt like it was burning from the inside out, while his lungs went into convulsions, sucking small amounts of water into them. The sensation was worse than anything he could imagine. It felt like he was being crushed, like an ocean's worth of water had invaded his head, scalding and searing the fragile air sacs behind his nose and above his eyes. The pain was now more intense than any he'd experienced, and this had only gone on for 30 seconds. The weight of it all grew worse still. His head was ready to explode. He wanted it to. His throat pumped in a gagging reflex, and he choked on more water pouring down his windpipe. He heard agitated voices speaking in a language he didn't know, and wondered if he was hearing angels calling to him. And then the towel was taken away, and the table tilted so that his head was much higher than his feet. Water jetted from his nose and mouth, and he retched painfully, but he could breathe. And while his lungs still burned and the air tasted of death, it was the sweetest breath he'd ever taken. They gave him less than a minute before the table slammed back down and the soaking wet towel was once again pressed over his face. The water came, gallons of it, tons of it, tsunami waves of it. This time, he could only exhale a few seconds before it again pooled inside his head. His sinuses filled up to the rim of his nostrils, and they could hold no more. With that came the agony and the panic, and his brain screaming at him to do something, to fight, to struggle, to break free. Cabrillo ignored the pitiable cries of his own mind and took the abuse without moving a muscle, because the truth was that he knew he wasn't drowning, that the men would let him breathe again, and that he had control over what his body did, not instinct, not his hindbrain. It was his intellect that ruled his actions. He lay as calm and still as a man taking a nap. At some point, one of the guards was sent to fetch another gallon jug of water, and for a total of 15 times, Juan was drowned and then allowed to breathe, drowned and then allowed to breathe. Every time, the soldiers expected Juan to break and beg for mercy. And every time, he lay back down after catching his breath and goaded them by nodding to them to do it again. The last session, they let it go so long that he passed out, and they had to unshackle him quickly and force the water from his body and revive him with a couple of slaps to the cheek. "Apparently," the interrogator said while Juan panted and snorted water out of his sinuses, "you do not want to tell me what I want to know." Cabrillo shot him a look. "Like I told you earlier, I came here for the waters." He was heaved off the table and dragged to a cell down a short, stark corridor. The room was unbelievably hot, with absolutely no air movement. Juan was dumped on the bare concrete floor. The metal door was slammed, and the lock shot home. There was a single caged light high up on a wall, a slop bucket, and a few handfuls of dirty straw on the cement floor. His cellmate was about the most emaciated cockroach he'd ever seen.
"So, what are you in for, buddy?" he asked the insect.
It waved its antenna at him in response. He finally was able to examine the back of his head and was amazed that the bone wasn't broken. The gash had doubtlessly bled, but the waterboarding had cleaned out the wound. His concussion was still with him, yet he could think clearly, and his memory was unaffected. It was a medical myth, unless showing symptoms of brain injury, that a concussed person should stay awake following the injury, but with his lungs afire and his body aching all over, he knew that sleep would not come. He found that the only comfortable position was flat on his back, with his injured arm bent across his chest. He thought back to the firefight in the jungle, examining every instant like he had with the terrorist attack in Singapore. He saw Linda on one knee behind the stone pillar, her petite body shaking every time her rifle discharged. He saw McDee's back as he ran ahead of him, recalling that Lawless's foot almost slipped from the rope once. There was Smith, reaching the far cliff and whirling around the second anchor pillar. Juan recalled looking at his own feet again and trying not to stare into the maddened river almost 100 feet below him. He then looked up and saw Smith open fire, and then the rope disintegrated ahead of McDee. Cabrillo ran the scene through his mind again and again, like a cop reviewing surveillance footage. He concentrated on Smith's rifle as it roared on full auto. He was aiming across the river at the soldiers chasing them. He was sure of it. So who had fired the rounds that hit the rope bridge? It couldn't have been anyone on the cliff behind him. They were all under cover far enough from the edge that they couldn't get an angle to shoot at the dropping rope. The two soldiers who'd fallen down the gorge when the rope came apart wouldn't have done it. He clearly saw Linda blasting away, but Smith's outline was blurred in his memory. Juan blamed his headache. Usually, he could recall every detail and nuance, but not now. Besides which, cold was leaching up through the concrete and settling into his bones. He stood, feeling dizzy enough to need to place a hand on the wall. Without his artificial leg, there really wasn't anything he could do. He waited until the dizziness passed, but didn't trust his balance enough to hop around the cell. On a lark, he measured it out using his exact 6-foot height. It was 12 by 12. He did the math in his head. The diagonal would be a touch under 17 feet. He tested his calculation, knowing that his boot was 13 inches long. His arithmetic was spot on. "The brain's still working," he said to the cockroach, which was moving about in the scattered stalks of hay. "Okay, think. What the hell is bothering me?" There was something about the destroyed camp. He recalled a feeling of confusion that there was an item out of place. No, not out of place, missing. There were certain things a woman out camping for more than a month would have brought with her, and they were things that men had absolutely no reason to steal. Soleil Quasar's pack had been in the tent and emptied. There hadn't been any face cream or lip balm or feminine products of any kind. Had the body he'd almost recovered been a woman's? He hadn't seen her face, but the build and hair color had been Soleil's. It had to be her. And whatever female luxuries she'd packed into Myanmar must be in the ditty bag he'd recovered and handed off to Smith. It had been waterlogged, so there was no way to judge its true weight, and thus no way to guess at its contents, but that had to be it. She and her companion, Paul Bissonnette, hey, the memory ain't so bad after all, must have heard or seen the army patrol approaching. She grabbed up her most personal items, and together they lit out into the jungle and eventually to the ruined Buddhist temple. Then why wasn't he satisfied? Had he seen her face, there would be no doubt, but he hadn't. He couldn't make a positive identification, and that left a loose end, something he professionally and personally hated. Of course, he had bigger things to worry about than the past. Cabrillo hoped against hope that their Burmese captors would leave McDee alone. It was obvious from his and Lawless's ages that Juan was the senior man here, so they should concentrate all of their attention on him. He just didn't think that was going to happen. He had an idea of what Lawless was made of. He was tough and resourceful, but did he have the kind of metal it took to go through what Juan had just experienced and not break? Cabrillo hadn't known that about himself, so he had no idea if the kid could take it. In the end, Juan thought, what did it really matter if McDee broke? What did he know, really? The client's name and the mission to go find his daughter wandering the Burmese jungle? The Oregon? He knew her name, but had no idea of her real capabilities. Juan's identity? Who the hell would care? He'd been out of the CIA long enough that he couldn't be considered an intelligence asset. No, he thought, McDee could spill his guts out and it wouldn't really change a thing. He now hoped that Lawless was bright enough to see this and spare himself any pain. Somehow, as exhaustion began to dull his own aches and he felt himself drifting toward sleep, he suspected that McDee would keep quiet if only to prove himself worthy of joining the corporation. Cabrillo had no idea how much time had passed. He'd come to on the waterboard without his watch when he woke with a start. He was bathed in sweat and panting.
"Son of a bitch!" he shouted aloud.
It had come to him during his sleep, a clear vision of John Smith firing at the cable. He had intentionally shot the thing to pieces. Rage boiled in Juan's veins. Smith had set them up. No, Roland Quasar had set them up. That hadn't been a woman's body in the river. It had been a slender man. And the bag didn't contain feminine toiletries. In it was something they had plundered from the temple, something hidden beneath the dais where the Buddha statue had once sat, and Juan had handed it to Smith, pretty as you please. This had never been about rescuing any daughter. Quasar had sent his own team into the jungle, and they'd failed to recover some item, so he'd hired the corporation to finish their mission.
God, what an idiot I am.
Then, through the fog of anger, came the realization that Linda Ross was with Smith and had no idea he had a completely different agenda than she knew. Would he just kill her now that he had what he wanted? The question burned in Juan's mind. Logic said that he wouldn't. It would be easier for him if she were to explain to Max and the rest what had happened to McDee and Cabrillo. And once he was aboard the Oregon, he simply needed to wait until transport back to civilization could be arranged. He felt a measure of relief. Linda would be okay. But the idea of Smith and Quasar's betrayal sent his blood pressure through the roof. How could he not have seen it? He thought back, looking for signs or clues. That audio message Quasar supposedly had received from his daughter was obviously faked. It had just the right note of mystery and desperation to whet Cabrillo's interest. He had wanted this mission because there was a frightened young woman, a damsel in distress, he thought bitterly of his own stupid sense of chivalry, who needed saving. Quasar had played him for a chump. Cabrillo looked at the suicide bombing at the hotel under a new light, but he couldn't see an angle that benefited the Swiss financier's master plan. That wasn't staged. Those men were looking to kill as many people as they could. It was just luck that he and Max had survived. There was no way Quasar was behind it. Of that he was certain. He couldn't recall the last time he'd been duped. He couldn't remember the last time someone had even bluffed him at poker. He'd always prided himself on knowing all the angles, thinking three steps ahead, and having an edge over everyone he dealt with. How could he not have seen it? The question played through his mind on a never-ending loop. There was no answer. Mark and Eric had vetted Quasar. The guy was just a businessman. What the hell was he playing at? Why the subterfuge? And then came another question he couldn't possibly answer. What had been in the bag that made it worth sending the first pair of explorers and then shelling out millions to the corporation when they fell off the radar? Cabrillo lay with his back propped up against the cement wall of his cell, while a sea of unknowns filled his brain.